From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. It was 1975 when Martha Peterson's plane landed in Moscow and launched her assignment as an American case officer for the CIA inside Russia. After training at CIA headquarters in Virginia, she would be one of the first women in U.S. history to embark on such a mission. Less than 2 years after her arrival on a cold November day in Moscow, she would be ambushed at a drop site, arrested, and hauled in for questioning by KGB agents. Martha Peterson's story is now part of an exhibit in two museums, including Moscow's KGB Museum and the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. She's part of a new CNN series on U.S. spies and secret operations called Declassified, and she's written a book about her journey from being the wife of a paramilitary officer in Laos to taking on her own special operations in Russia called the Widow Spy. Marty Peterson, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you, Rachel. I'm glad to be here.
And we're inviting you to join the conversation. If you have a question about life in the CIA, send it to coastline at whqr.org. A bit later in the program, we'll open the phone lines. Marty Peterson, you didn't start out your work life with the intention of becoming a case officer inside the CIA. You actually followed your first husband, John, to Laos, where he was a paramilitary officer. What was he doing in Laos, and how much did you actually know about what he was doing at the time?
Rachel, it's very interesting. I knew very little. I had no briefings from the CIA when we were assigned there. John came home and said, we're off to Laos in a month. And so I had to get the inoculations, and we boarded the plane, and off we went. And that was in June of 1971. I must say, I was quite naive, but in general, I knew what our mission was there. It was to interdict the North Vietnamese Army as it came down the Ho Chi Minh Trail to South Vietnam, and our mission there was to train the local Lao troops to go out and engage the North Vietnamese troops to keep them from getting to South Vietnam.
How long had you been married to John when you found out that you were headed to Laos?
It was about less than 2 years. He'd been in training during some of that time, but we had gotten married after he came back from Vietnam as an Army officer. So he was a Green Beret officer. And so I knew that he liked those kind of things, so this wasn't a great shock.
But going to Laos was a great shock in a lot of ways, culturally, adjusting to the house. You had some interesting experiences when you first arrived, getting used to the flora and fauna there.
Yes, the house was it was on stilts, but it had a screened-in porch on the bottom. And, you know, there were a lot of little geckos and little cockroaches, of course. They were our best friends, and snakes and even things that, you know, would worry most people. But, you know, we were young, and we do and accept things. It was like camping out in many ways.
And you talked in your book, The Widow Spy, about asking that you had a lot of household help. You had a maid and a cook. Was that the same person?
No, that was the same person.
Okay.
And she was Vietnamese Thai and spoke no known language to me. So it was mostly hand gestures and, you know, smiling and hoping she understood.
And you asked her to wash the produce in Clorox?
Yes, that was standard. We would fill the sink and put a cup or so of Clorox, just regular laundry Clorox, in there and soak the vegetables, the leafy things, not the peeled things. But when I left 2 years later, I found that gallon of Clorox under the sink. It had never been touched. So I guess I didn't explain it very well to her.
But you obviously survived that okay. You didn't have a lot of stomach issues.
Well, we always had stomach issues from eating in the Chinese restaurants out or the Lao Officers Club. The small little places we ate always had questionable cleanliness, and it didn't bother you. It was part of life.
And there was a night that you recount in the book about waking up, and there was a creature in the bed with you?
Yeah, it was under under the sheets, and I could feel this thing crawling up my thigh. And it was dreadful to even contemplate what it might be. So I threw the sheet back. I brushed it out of the bed and stomped on it. It was a black mark in the floor the next morning. But it was a cockroach of great size. Yeah.
So you went to Laos as part of your husband's career. You wound up working yourself while you were there. And this was a little bit of an adjustment for you as well, because you were not uneducated. You came with a master's degree from UNC, and yet your job while you were in Laos was secretarial.
Right. They put all the wives to work there because it kept us involved in our husband's career and kept us from spending the afternoons drinking margaritas and and gossiping and all the things that wives do when they're left to their own. So I did have a master's degree, and I was assigned secretarial work where I filed and typed and packed the pouch and all. It was, in a way, degrading, but it was also such an adventure, and it was a wonderful place to be.
You include in your book some journal entries from your first husband, John. Are these things that you were aware of at the time, or did you discover these journals later?
In the evening, Rachel, when he'd come home, we'd have dinner, and then we would sit quietly together. And sometimes he sat at our little typewriter and would write notes. And I knew he needed that to kind of come down from the day and what he'd been seeing and doing. And when I came here to write the book, when I moved to Wilmington and I started writing the book, there was a memory of that journal, and I went and looked for it. I really hadn't read the whole thing through, I don't think, before then, or maybe it had been too painful earlier. So I read the journal and found that so much of it was part of my book. You know, it spoke to what I was trying to write about.
What was that like for you to read it? Did it, so many years later?
It was...
Was it painful?
No. You know what it was? It was like wanting to talk to someone who has passed away. You want to ask more questions. Why didn't I ask him then? Why didn't I read them then? Why didn't we understand one another better? Or it was just those unanswered questions that we all have too late. And that was what that was.
One of the journal entries that you include from John about the Vietnam War, it's pretty heart-wrenching. He talks about fighting a war from a Machiavellian point of view, and he writes, "After our troops fail miserably, we wonder what is wrong. The entire project is wrong." What was he talking about there?
He was talking about the politicians running the war, and I think that is a very common thing to have happen in any war situation. But there he was seeing so many thousands of men being killed in a war that was not really being run by the people on the ground. And I think he worried that in Laos we were doing similar things.
And, of course, you lost him
right
over there. He
right.
died in a helicopter crash, and you foreshadow his death in the book. Did you actually have a sense that his death was coming before he died?
Yes. I you know, it was strange, Rachel. A month before John died, or 3 weeks, a very good friend of his died up north in Laos, and John was away at the time that Ray died. And when John got home, we sat on the sofa, and I said, I just can't accept that. That's just not acceptable for a young man to die like that. And he said, Marty, we're in a war. It isn't pretend. This is the real deal. And he gave me instructions about what to do if something should happen to him.
And his death was deeply traumatic for you.
At 27, you don't expect anyone you know to die, you know, and it was unbelievable. I watched his friends and my friends stand around me looking at me, and it was almost more painful watching their tears, because I couldn't even fathom what had happened to me and the change that was coming when I got home without him. my whole life.
You're 27 years old and you're in this country, this Asian country, by yourself. You have some friends there, but your family is, of course, back in the United States.
Right.
And when you came home, when you flew back, what happened then? Where did you go?
Well, you know, I went to Florida where my parents had retired, and I sat by the pool, and my dad, he would come down and sit and take my hand, or he'd just sit there quietly with me because he knew I had to kind of work through this event and find some sanity to it. And my mother and I would go out, and she would try to say things that were meaningful to help me to find a way forward. But it was most difficult until I had to go to Washington to sign some legal papers. And while I was there, I went to see my friends Tom and Gerald, who had also been in Laos with us. And we sat around the dining room table with their brand new baby and drank wine out of gallons of wine. It was gallows wine. You know, we don't drink wine like that.
Those big jugs.
Yes. Who knew how good it was? And and Tom said to me, "Marty, why don't you do what John intended to do? You're able. You speak three languages." I had a master's degree. I'd lived overseas. I'd worked. I had all the qualifications on paper. So it was just trying to make that happen, which became somewhat difficult.
And that's when you launched your, that's when the trajectory of your life changed and started heading towards Moscow.
That's right. And that's the story.
And we will come back and we'll hear about your training and what it's like to go to Moscow as a young woman and ultimately start collecting intelligence. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. Marty Peterson is with us today, one of the first women to work for the CIA as a case officer in Russia. After this short break, we'll open the phone lines. If you have a question, call us at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. You're listening to Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. We're talking with Marty Peterson about her career as a case officer for the CIA. She was a key figure in collecting intelligence from Trigon, one of the more important Russian spies for the United States, and we'll hear more about Trigon later. The phone lines are now open. If you have a question for Marty Peterson about her story, which is chronicled in her book called The Widow Spy, give us a call at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Marty Peterson, just before we went to break, you had left Laos after the death of your first husband, John, in a helicopter crash and came home to Florida where you mourned him. And suddenly, over several jugs of Gallo wine with your friends Tom and Gerald, you decided that you were going to put all of this education and experience and facility with other languages into use. Tell us about that. Tell us about going to the CIA.
Well, Rachel, I actually had a contact there, of course, and he led me to a mentor who thought, like I did, that I had something to offer to the CIA, which was different. And so he set me up with a recruiter, and I went on a Thursday afternoon to sit with him, and we chatted. And what was interesting, he kept asking about my, not my education or experience, but more my secretarial skills or my administrative abilities. I think I probably even took a test, a typing test. Do they even give typing tests anymore?
Do male officers have to take typing tests?
Probably not. And at the end of this interview of an hour, this man, who I don't even know his name and it probably wasn't even his true name, he offered me a secretarial position. And I said, you know, that's not what I was here for, and that's not what I find interesting or acceptable. So I probably won't be taking that. I won't be back to you.
And once again, you had an advanced degree.
Yeah. It was not like I had a degree in international relations. It was in psychology and sociology. But it was a degree which, you know, the fellows that were hired in the same position I wanted didn't even have that. They had military experience, which translates as well. You know, it's experience. It's life experience. Mm-hmm. It's understanding the world and having gone through experiences. So
how did you get past this person who couldn't see through your gender to the qualifications and the intelligence and the potential that was there?
Well, I X'd him out. I never went back to see him. And my mentor, this man who really was very sincere in wanting to see me succeed, then had me interview with another man who wanted a girl Friday in Spain. Well, that wasn't going to be acceptable to me. So eventually...
And when you say girl Friday, you're talking about an administrative position, but possibly benefits.
Yeah, aside benefits, probably. And not being part of the official structure, having an apartment kind of thing. It was...
A kept woman.
Yeah, clearly not where I wanted to be. Yeah. And it was not a professional thing that I wanted to do. So... I finally got to the people who interviewed for case officers, for operations officers, for people who would go out and collect intelligence from secret agents around the world. And that's what I wanted to do.
So you embarked on training, and you were offered some sort of less cloak and dagger sorts of assignments at first, weren't you, before Moscow came up?
Yeah, it's very interesting. Women have a very good network. We do. We know how to talk to one another because I think women don't compete with one another in the same way as men do. So these women who had been in these positions I was offered before me came up to me and said, Marty, those are women's positions. They want girls in those positions. And I knew that wasn't what I wanted to do. I wanted to be equal and not equal, but to be able to do the work that the other officers who are as qualified as I. You know, that was what I was headed for.
So then you got the offer to go to Moscow. And what kind of training did you have to go through? What did you need to learn before you went over to Russia?
Well, first, Rachel, I had to learn 44 weeks of Russian language. That was every day of the week from 8 to 4 every day. That was learning the Cyrillic language, the Cyrillic alphabet, and then all the language and all the cultural pieces that go along with the language. It was interesting. My instructors were from St. Petersburg. That means they were born and lived there before Leningrad existed. So they were before the communist government. It was very interesting. So their cultural understanding was very old. And I was going into a very communist, literal society. So some of that was misspent in the language training. But I came out with a good fluency and a good appreciation for a beautiful language. It really is. And what I was, you know, how I was going to have to speak it and use it every day.
And when you went over there, you wound up collecting intelligence and conducting what you call dead drops with a Russian person named Trigon. That was the CIA's nickname for this man.
Right.
How did you learn how to do these drops? Because there are so many protocols that you needed to follow, and you needed to figure out that you didn't have Russian surveillance. What kind of training did you go through in Virginia about seeking out surveillance?
It was very rigorous training on the street, actually. We had surveillance following us. We would case a site. It's kind of like criminal talk, but it is the same activity. You go and you look who's around and you see what kind of patterns are in the neighborhood where you have found a potential site where you could put down a dead drop, a brick, an oily glove, a piece of trash.
These are containers.
That's
that
right.
Are disguises for information.
That's right. Inside, we put what we want the agent to have, and in turn, the agent returns to this site and gives us that kind of information back. The secrets that he has photographed from his office in the Soviet government.
So you're not meeting the agent in the park and saying, "Hi, Trigon, nice to see you. You got something for me?" It's not like that. You can't cross his path.
No, because I was an American diplomat, and I had some, you know, I was recognized in part, or I could be. He and I never met, actually. We only did dead drops. And people sometimes think dead drops are like dead birds or dead. No, it's not dead animals. It is an inert object that lays there on the ground. Nobody wants it. You make sure it isn't trash that someone can reuse, even. It's supposed to be very repugnant. And inside is the money and the instructions to Trigon. And then he, in turn, would leave a package for me in the same place when he would pick up my package for him. So we did kind of an exchange, but within an hour in between.
And you've talked about some of his drops as being milk cartons that looked like they had vomit on them.
Yes.
So
yes.
No one would pick it up.
No, and it always looked like vomit or baby poop or something. I always carried a plastic bag because it was so repugnant, nobody would touch it.
But if someone did, if an innocent, say, Soviet citizen happened to pick it up and open it up, what would they find?
In it, they would find a condom with miniature cassettes tied inside this condom to keep them dry and clean, and also a roll of 35-millimeter film, which was his photographed personal note to us in Moscow, in the station in Moscow. We never developed that miniature film in Moscow. Our tech didn't want to make a mistake with real good live intelligence.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking with Martha Peterson, CIA case officer, one of the first female officers to head to Russia during the Cold War and collect intelligence, working with one of the more well-known Russian spies of that era, Trigon. Her book, The Widow Spy, tells the whole story, and she is ready to take your questions. You can give us a call today at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. So who was Trigon? For people who have never heard this story, how important was Trigon for U.S. intelligence, and how did the United States find him?
Trigon was an official with the Soviet government, and he was posted in Bogota, Colombia. We learned about him through a telephone tap we had on the Soviet embassy there at the time, and we discovered that he had habits and ways of living that were pretty non-Soviet. He colored outside the lines. And we decided we would approach him because we were looking for Soviets who would be willing to provide us with intelligence about what the Soviet government was planning, what their intentions were in Bogota as well as the rest of Latin America. So through this telephone tap, we learned about him and his local girlfriend. He was married at the time. His wife was there in the embassy as well, but he liked women and womanized. And so we contacted this one woman, and she put us in touch with him. He was very willing to cooperate with us, and I think he even had thought of what he could earn money-wise from spying.
Was that his biggest impetus to cooperate with the U.S. government? Was it the money?
I think most spies that we had at the time, that part was very important, money. It also was trying to express something about their own government and their dissatisfaction with their own government.
In the book, you talk about him saying frequently that he would change things from the inside, and it almost sounded like he had a sort of moral explanation for why he was doing this.
Yes, but most spies do make up a moral explanation to justify why they're being a traitor. And, you know, people often ask, well, isn't this what Rick Ames, who was a CIA spy, or Robert Hansen, who was an FBI spy, those are the same things. I mean, they were unhappy with their system or the treatment of them. And so Trigon had that same characteristic. It is a characteristic of why people are traitors, why they turn against their own country.
So you've arrived in Moscow. You're a young woman who you've had some Russian language training, but you're not greeted at the airport by a team of people who are ready to welcome you and show you the ropes. You're pretty much left on your own when you first get there. What was that like? Where did you go?
Oh, Rachel, I looked out from the door of that airplane and I thought, what have I done? Here I am all by myself here. Although I did have a station full of people, I could not socialize with them. I couldn't be seen with them because they wanted me to be sterile. They wanted me not to have any possible connection to CIA. So I really was on my own. I had my own apartment and I didn't go to parties with them. I wasn't seen in the cafeteria. I had to go it alone. Although they were there in a secret place within the embassy and I could go there and talk to them. But outside of that place in the embassy, which we call the station, I had to make it on my own. I had to make my own friends and build a character, a person who was believable as an embassy employee.
Because we're assuming that KGB is watching you. They may not know that you work for CIA. You work at the American embassy.
Right. And the Soviet KGB watched everyone when they first arrived to see the patterns that you were building in life. And of course, what I was doing was making friends with other young women. I was going to the Marine House on Wednesday night to watch movies. I was drinking beer at the Marine House. I bought a little car. I went out touring. That was what normal non-CIA people were expected to do. So that's what they saw.
And as you're touring around in your car, what kind of a car was it?
It was a Zhiguli. It was bright orange. You'd think I would have bought a gray car, but they only had certain colors at the time, and that was the one I chose.
And you would tour around, and that actually gave you a good chance to case the city and find spots for your dead drops.
That's exactly right. And I took other ladies from the embassy with me because we'd go out and see historic churches. Most of the churches were museums then. They didn't allow the religion. But we would go out to some of the working churches, and I always took ladies with me. And, of course, they had no clue what I was doing on the side, that I was CIA. They thought that I was just another young woman. What was interesting, I took pictures using a Nikon camera that John and I had purchased in Hong Kong when we were traveling to Laos. And it was a magical thing to use his camera to take pictures of dead drops along with the churches and casing pictures using this camera.
Do you remember what it was like to do your very first dead drop when you had to leave the first package for Trigon?
I'll never forget that, Rachel.
What was that like?
It was a cold, dark, wasn't stormy. It was very cold, though. It was in December, January. And as I walked along the path headed to the dead drop, I saw a man in the distance, and I really froze, thinking that maybe it was a KGB watching me. But as I walked, I realized there were other people out and around. But he stood still. I mean, he was quite a long ways away. And I stopped and leaned against the snowbank next to the lamp pole. And I took the package out, and I let it slide down the side of the iced kind of dimple around the pole.
If somebody had been watching you,
they would have never seen what I did because I just was leaning there. It was a small package. So I left the area and I had instructions that I should come back a couple hours later to make sure Trigon had been there and picked up the package.
And so you were just passing by later to make sure that the package was gone.
Right.
He wasn't leaving anything for you at that point.
No, this was our first drop to him. And as I came back 2 hours later, yes, you can imagine, the package was still there, my first drop, and he didn't come and pick it up. So I had to lean down and pick it up, put it in my purse, and return back to my apartment.
And that sounds like a simple thing, lean down and pick up the package. But it wasn't simple. That was a whole drama, just that motion of picking up the package. Why?
Yes, because there were people out on the street, casuals, that would, of course, then be curious about what it was that I was picking up. Why would she lean over that snowbank? So you had to do it kind of very casually, lean over, put it in your purse, and walk on. And it had to be very smooth, and you had to have a flow to what you were doing.
And there were also some cultural elements of living in Russia that were completely new. You had a dragon lady on the floor of your hotel when you first arrived.
Yeah, I stayed at the Peking Hotel, and every hotel had women on every floor, and they kept the keys. You couldn't leave your room and go out of the hotel without dropping your key, and we called her the Dragon Lady, and every floor had one.
And so they always knew where you were and what you were doing.
At least they knew when you weren't in your hotel that way, because then they could go in and what we call toss your belongings, toss your suitcase and look for anything incriminating, different, or anything spy-like.
So that's your hotel. Once you're in your flat in Moscow, did that happen also? Did people go into your apartment when you weren't there?
Yes, they had keys to everything. They had keys to your apartment, your car, everything. And I knew they came into my apartment occasionally. That's why we left nothing personal, letters, bills, anything in our apartment. I knew that once because I took John's camera out to go shoot some pictures, and the mirror had been flipped up. It was a 35-millimeter camera. And, you know, it wasn't broken, but I knew somebody had been messing with it.
So they didn't take a lot of pains to cover their tracks.
No, they almost wanted you to know that they had been there.
And your first night taking a bath, you thought, huh, they might be watching me right now.
Yeah, who knows? You know, maybe there was a camera, maybe there was a microphone. Even married couples, had the hardest time with that. You know, in lovemaking, there's noise, and having someone listen to you would be a little disturbing, I think. You know, we didn't plan on X-rated a tour in Moscow.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking with Marty Peterson about her journey from Laos to Moscow. She's chronicled this in her book, The Widow Spy. After this 90-second break, we'll return for the final segment, and it's your last chance to get your question in. You can call us at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. You're listening to Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Today we're talking with Martha Peterson, one of the first women to work for the CIA as a case officer, gathering intelligence in Moscow during the Cold War. She's written a book chronicling that journey, which ultimately led to an arrest, which we're about to hear about. We'll hear about that fateful night in a few moments. And you have a few minutes left to ask your question. You can give us a call at 910-343-1138 or email us today at coastline@whqr.org. And we have Eileen from Charlotte. Welcome to Coastline, Eileen. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I've been listening to this wonderful interview, and I just wanted to say how inspiring it is. I'm 31 years old. I just received my master's in elementary education. I have an undergrad in theater, and I plan on joining the military reserves, either the Navy or Coast Guard, and eventually going with the United Nations. But Marty, it's women like you that have set this high standard for us of all ages, that we have to accept the fact that we have so much more to offer than what men have put us in these roles. And I just think it's so wonderful that you did not accept that first interview and that you challenged the system and said, I want more, I am capable of more. And I just wanted to thank you for doing that.
Well, thank you very much. It's you know, at the time, and I think you will also think this years from now, you don't really think of what you're doing. You just follow your instincts. You take the opportunities that are there for you. I'm very proud of you. Taking on a piece of a military career is big, and I know you'll succeed because you understand that this is important as well.
Eileen, thank you so much for that call. You really have left a legacy, and we'll hopefully get to that before the end of the show about your training of other people coming up as case officers and how they should act if they've been arrested. Because the point that Eileen makes about you just forging ahead and doing your thing, you acted like that during the arrest. But let's get to that. So you've been exchanging packages with Trigon, this important Russian spy who's been delivering intelligence about the Russian government to the United States, to CIA. And so we're there. It's Friday night. It's July 15th, 1977. And some things have been deteriorating in terms of the information that you've been getting from Trigon. It hasn't been as good. What's been happening up to this point?
Well, what we were hearing from headquarters, because they were the ones reading his intelligence, was that there were anomalies in his reporting. It wasn't consistent with what we had heard before. So we had run out of dates for our exchanges, Trigon and I, and so we sent a radio broadcast to him instructing him to come to a site on a railroad bridge over the Moscow River. The site was actually codenamed Setun, and we told Trigon to be there at 10, 10:30 to pick up the package that I would leave for him. I had real trepidations going out that night. I had read the signal that morning, and the signal itself was alerting. The
signal that he said yes, that said yes, I'm on board for this drop tonight.
Tonight, that's right.
The signal was strange.
Yes, it was. One, he never made signals. Two, occasionally he did. This one was like it had been stenciled in red. So I was really concerned. But, you know,
went ahead.
Yes. Our agents are the most important thing in the world. If you recruit an agent, that means you are committed to his security, his safety, and putting out for him, going that extra mile, and even if there's doubts.
So you were putting your safety behind his.
Absolutely. But, you know, Rachel, I would never pretend to say that I didn't have an escape hatch myself. I had diplomatic immunity. So an agent loses his life if he's caught. I'm thrown out of a country. That's the bottom line.
And so, that's something else with Trigon. You had the CIA had gone back and forth and had a real moral sort of dilemma about whether to provide him with poison to end his life if he were caught.
Right.
Ultimately decided to give it to him.
Yes, we did provide him a pen with some poison in it in the event he was arrested and tortured. So that night I went to that bridge with all this running around in my head, but knowing that it was what I had to do personally. So I got to the bridge. I was a little early. I walked up the river, the side of the river on the sidewalk. I then turned around and came back towards the bridge, and I saw three men across the street. They all had long sleeve white shirts on, and in the twilight of Moscow's summer nights, they kind of radiated or glowed. They walked in down a path into a cemetery there, a very famous cemetery. I continued onto the bridge. I climbed the 43 steps to the top of this railroad bridge, and there were four towers. The pedestrian walkway went through two of them on the right side of the bridge. So I started through the one tower, and I stopped in the middle of it. I took out his package, a piece of asphalt concrete, and I put it in a little window there. I walked out onto the bridge. In the middle of the bridge, I stood there and I listened and watched, and there was no one around. So I returned back through that tower and headed down the stairs. As I got to the bottom of the stairs, these three men came towards me across the street. The middle one made a motion to the other to fan out and not let me run. And then I knew I was in trouble. I knew something had happened to Trigon. I knew I wasn't going to be raped or mugged at that point. And they grabbed me by my arms. I hadn't been grabbed like that since I was 4 years old, I'm sure. And I was angry. I knew something
had
happened.
You were angry.
I was
you
angry.
You were terrified. You were angry, and you're kicking them in the shins.
Well, among other
and
things.
I mean, what about other people might think,
I might wind up in Lubyanka and never come out. And you're kicking these KGB goons in the shins. And there's even, urban legend says you sent a couple to the hospital, but
right.
You don't know if that's true.
No, I don't know that's true. But, you know, it was my first reaction because something had happened to Trigon if they were there. No one had followed me that night. I knew they hadn't followed me. I'd driven all over the city and no one had followed me. And there they were waiting for me. It was an ambush. And there I was in the hands of KGB, knowing that something had happened to Trigon, and I was hot, red hot, mad. Anger was my first reaction and only reaction. But you know, when you get angry, you forget to turn on that mental recorder. So I had to calm down and look at faces and try to remember what they all looked like and to record in my mind what all they were saying to get clues about what had happened to Trigon.
So they take you in a van.
Yes, they do.
And pull up to the back of Lubyanka prison.
Right. That was where Stalin used to take people and they never came back.
At this point, are you a little worried that your diplomatic immunity might not work?
No, we had a good agreement with the Soviet government. You know, if the FBI kicked someone, the KGB would kick someone. It was kind of a tit for tat.
So physically, you knew that you were safe.
I was safe, yes.
And then you went into a conference room where you were interrogated.
I wasn't really interrogated because the chief interrogator really wasn't interested in letting anyone else know what had happened. It was very clear to me that he was the only one that really knew what had happened to Trigon and how we had gotten to this point.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking with Marti Peterson, CIA case officer, one of the first female officers to head to Russia during the Cold War and collect intelligence. And we have Cherokee from Wilmington. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air. Cherokee, are you there?
This is Frank from New York.
Hi, Frank.
Hi, good afternoon. Question for Marti. Did you ever feel that you were under surveillance by the Soviets after you returned to the States?
That's a very interesting question, actually. Very few people ever think about that because we don't think that happens here. Only once did I think that perhaps someone had entered our house in Falls Church, Virginia. There were things missing, and someone had stolen my garage door opener. So, yeah, it was very strange. And not only that, the things they took were, cross pens and rolled coins. And Frank, very interesting, a couple of weeks later, that garage door opener reappeared in my car. Yeah, that was strange. And so I had security check it out.
Wow. Frank, thank you so much for your call. And this should be Cherokee from Wilmington. Welcome to Coastline, Cherokee. You're on the air. Are you there? I guess Cherokee has disappeared. So perhaps some Russian surveillance.
Yes.
Who knows? So you are then rescued ultimately by your office, by people from the American Embassy, from CIA.
Right. The Soviets eventually call someone from the embassy, the U.S. Embassy, and they come down and they're shocked to see me, of course, because they didn't know I lived this double life, and they take me back to the embassy, and I leave the next day to fly home to Washington.
And you ultimately continued your career for a while with the CIA in the United States, and you say that one of the things that you did during that time was teach other up-and-coming case officers, and one of the things you talked about was how to behave during an arrest. What did you learn from your arrest in Moscow, and would you, if you could go back and do it differently, would you?
No, I think instinctually I knew not to speak anything but English during my arrest. I knew eventually I would be sent home, so I didn't have that fear. But I think that my telling people what to expect took an edge off the clear possibility of being arrested, which we all were at that time during the Cold War.
And going back to that night, July 15th, 1977, you went ahead with the plans, even though there had been some new people coming into your office. There were new members of that CIA team. And you felt, you talk about this in the book, that they weren't quite as knowledgeable or maybe not even as careful, precise as some of the previous team members. And yet, so all your spidey senses were up, and yet you went forward.
Right. It takes a while to learn a city, especially if what you're doing is spying in that city and collecting dead drops. And I felt that the people that had come in maybe either didn't fully appreciate the KGB's ability to follow them and to arrest our spies. So I think they also were not as aware of my history there and how hard I'd worked.
And you do spend a lot of time in the book talking about surveillance and looking around and making sure that you don't have any. And you were an odd case that way, because most of the CIA employees at that point, eventually the KGB would get onto them and they would have a team. You even document some sort of funny situations in which Russian and American officers are spending some time together.
Right. The men in the station all had surveillance all the time. And, if they were on a trip outside of Moscow and they had a surveillance team and their car broke down, the KGB eventually would help them get this car started again, or the KGB would go to the ballet with them. But you see, the KGB didn't expect a woman to be out on the street doing that, and that was the key to my success there.
Because you were a woman.
Because
so
it was a woman.
It was an obstacle for you in some ways inside the CIA, but when it came to spying, it was actually an asset.
It actually was, yes.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking with Marty Peterson. Just a few minutes left. We have Doc from Wilmington. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you. I had an interesting experience. From 1995 through 2007, I worked as a supplier for a hotel development company in Moscow. The name of that company was Mospromstroy, and it was the company that originally was the KGB's construction company. And once the communism failed, they privatized. And so they were building new hotels, Western-style hotels in Moscow. And I got the opportunity, through a chance encounter, to become the supplier for all the furniture, fixtures, and equipment. Those hotels later became managed by Marriott and Holiday Inn Crowne Plaza.
But and Marty, I see you nodding. I see you nodding. You know what he's talking about.
Oh, yes. They put, listening devices in all kinds of furniture and hotels. And I think your experience is exceptional at that period of time.
Yes, it was very unusual. These guys were all former KGB people and very open about it. I mean, they were proud that they had privatized their KGB operation, and I had a great relation. They were very honorable, honest people. I never had to pay any bribes. They were great to work with. But during those years, I of course interfaced with the U.S. embassy, the Russian embassy here in the U.S., and because they have been in that agency that were supposedly promoting business between U.S. and Russia.
Doc, I'm sorry. We're going to have to cut you off. We are running out of time. Thank you so much for your call. Marty, you are part of an exhibit in a couple of museums, the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C., and also the KGB Museum in Moscow. Is it safe for you to travel to Russia now? How can you go as you were part of this intelligence gathering operation?
Well, after I returned from Moscow, I got the official word that I was declared persona non grata. And that means you can never return there. And PNG is forever in my book, especially with the government in Moscow now.
But
I would never go back.
You wouldn't go back?
Never.
Okay.
Mm-mm. I saw enough.
That's this edition of Coastline. Marty Peterson, where can people buy The Widow Spy?
The Widow Spy can be bought online, Amazon, or Barnes & Noble.
Amazon.com or Barnes & Noble. Thank you so much for coming on the show today, Marty. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you, Rachel. It was great. Thank you.
Coastline now goes back to Wednesday-only broadcasts for a couple of months. In September, we'll fire up the Thursday Coastline once again in time for political coverage. Coastline's executive producer is Cleve Callison. Today's producer is Claudia Thompson. Technical director is Ken Campbell. Aurora Shimshak engineered today's show. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org or get the podcast from the iTunes store. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.